Today is Monday, December 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up, Turkey's government is demanding that European governments help avert a new refugee crisis. Also ahead, a Saudi court sentences three men to death in the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, and UNESCO wants to extend a program to help refugees continue their educations or get jobs. It's all on today's International Edition. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says thousands of Syrian refugees are heading to the Turkish border, escaping the Damascus-led offensive in Idlib, the last rebel enclave. Erdogan warns Turkey can no longer accommodate any more refugees and he will send new arrivals to Europe. My colleague Kate Pondawson spoke with reporter Dorian Jones in Istanbul about the situation.
Well, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is warning that around 80,000 Syrian refugees in the enclave of Idlib are heading towards the Turkish frontier. They're escaping this bombardment by Damascus-led regime forces backed by Russian air power as they've been launching an offensive against the rebels. And Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has said he's committed to retaking all of Syrian territory, and Idlib has been a priority for him. This area is home for around 3 million people, of which half are believed to be refugees fleeing the conflict from other parts of the country. A third of that 3 million are believed to be children, and a major humanitarian crisis is looming.
Now, what is President Erdogan asking other countries to do to help with this situation, to help with these refugees?
Well, President Erdogan's message has been unequivocal. He's saying that this isn't just a problem for Turkey, this is a problem for the whole region, and in particular, Europe. He's been scathing of European countries for failing to, what he said, share the burden of this refugee crisis. Turkey is the world's record holder for the number of refugees, well over 3.5 million. He said that's cost the country nearly $40 billion. And he said they've only received a few billion from Europe. He said that's by far not enough. He said that they haven't shared this burden in terms of sharing the numbers and particularly not sharing in financial support. Now, he is warning that if there is another major exodus into Turkey, he says that he will open the frontiers of Turkey to Europe and allow these people to enter into seek refuge in across Europe. Now, if you recall, this is not an empty threat. In 2015, around 1 million refugees left Turkey to neighboring Greece. Most of those were Syrian refugees. And that not only caused a humanitarian crisis in Greece, but had major repercussions, politically, socially, all across Europe. And Brussels is very aware that they do not want to face another refugee crisis. So this threat from Erdogan will be taken very seriously.
Now, also, we have Turkish diplomats meeting with Russian officials. What's going on there?
Well, this is key, I think, for Ankara to try and avert this latest humanitarian crisis that is believed to be looming. Now, while Turkey and Russia back opposite sides in the Syrian civil war, Ankara, the Turkish president, Erdogan, has developed a very good relationship with the Russian president, Vladimir Putin. They have been cooperating in Syria in some ways to bring an end to this conflict. And those cooperation as part of a much wider rapprochement between these two countries to the scale that many of Turkey's Western allies are very alarmed at what they see as this drift towards Russia, and particularly in NATO, and in particular concerns are held in Washington over this. Now, Ankara will be looking to that relationship to avert another crisis. They had a stock agreement earlier this year in Idlib to end another Syrian regime offensive. Another agreement a year ago actually sees Turkish forces on the ground in the Syrian enclave enforcing a de-escalation zone, was also evidence of this working relationship with Moscow. Now, in spite of all those efforts, it does appear that the Syrian regime is determined to eventually remove the rebels from the Idlib area. But what Ankara, I think, is hoping for, at least in the short term of this meeting in Moscow, is that there could be some sort of ceasefire, that the Syrian regime will hold off from its ultimate goal of taking over the whole of this Idlib province, provoking possibly another million refugees into Turkey. Ankara, I think, is confident that some sort of deal will be made, because they also know that President Putin is looking to hear President Erdogan to provide impetus for a final settlement of the Syrian conflict.
That was journalist Dorian Jones in Istanbul speaking with VOA's Kate Bowne-Dawson. A court in Saudi Arabia today sentenced 5 people to death and 3 others to prison in connection with last year's killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The public prosecutor said those who directly participated in the murder received death sentences. Prison sentences were given to other defendants for covering up the crime. The sentences came after largely secret proceedings that also cleared Saud al-Qahtani, the former top aide to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, of being involved in Khashoggi's death. The Washington Post columnist and prominent critic of the Saudi government was slain in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Saudi Arabia initially denied Khashoggi had been killed and blamed rogue agents for his murder. The U.S. Central Intelligence Agency said it appeared Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the killing, and United Nations investigators said evidence links him to the murder. The Saudi government has denied the Crown Prince had any knowledge of the operation. U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said today he is not ruling out calling witnesses in President Donald Trump's impeachment trial, but he indicated he's in no hurry to do so. The House of Representatives voted Wednesday to impeach Trump, but the Senate trial may be held up until lawmakers can agree on how to proceed. New documents that came to light over the weekend added fuel to Democrats who say Trump improperly withheld aid from Ukraine unless its president, Volodymyr Zelensky, investigated former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter. Democrats in the House say that was an abuse of power because Trump was asking a foreign government to investigate his political rival. Julie Walker with the Associated Press has more.
Republicans and Democrats are still at an impasse over President Trump's impeachment trial as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi continues to hold out on delivering the articles of impeachment to the Senate. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell doesn't want new testimony. Minority Leader Chuck Schumer does, leaving open the possibility of a protracted delay. President Trump complained about the holdup Saturday.
It's so unfair. It's so unfair. She has no case.
But Schumer says they have even more evidence.
This email is explosive. A top administration official, one that we requested, is saying, stop the aid 91 minutes after Trump called Zelensky and said, keep it hush hush.
That email from senior White House budget official Michael Duffy, who Schumer wants to testify. Julie Walker, New York.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has not yet sent the articles of impeachment to the Senate. She has said she wants to make sure the Senate proceedings will be fair. The White House has argued that the president did nothing improper and the House investigation is unfair. Today, Trump tweeted, Pelosi gives us the most unfair trial in the history of the U.S. Congress, and now she is crying for fairness in the Senate. This is VOA's International Edition. UNESCO, the UN Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, reports it is expanding its qualification passport program, which enables refugees and vulnerable migrants to continue their studies or get employment in countries of exile. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
More often than not, refugees and migrants who have had a secondary or tertiary education at home have difficulty applying for higher education or finding work commensurate with their skills in their new countries. They often lack the certificates proving they have completed their studies. The UNESCO qualification passport is a standardized document which contains information about the person's qualifications, job experience, and language proficiency. UNESCO Assistant Director General for Education, Stefania Giannini, says the aim of the program is to help refugees without documents be recognized for their accomplishments by their hosting countries.
If you don't have anything, if you don't have papers which can be demonstrated, you know, you lose part of your life, you lose part of your competence, you lose part of your knowledge. So this is for to help refugees, but then there is the other side of the coin, which is to give hosting countries the opportunity to valorize human capital they have.
Syrian refugee Anwar Horani is the first qualifications passport holder. After graduating as a physiotherapist from Al-Bath University in Homs in 2016, she was forced to flee her country. She spent a year in Greece without the necessary documents to prove her qualifications. In 2017, she received the European Qualifications Passport, which she presented to officials in Norway, her new country of asylum. She says this document has changed her life.
For me, I was able to use this kind of documentation to pursue my study in the University of Oslo Met and achieve a course in international public health. And after 1.5 years from arriving in the country to have like 2 jobs in 2 different places in my new host country, Norway.
The UNESCO program is being piloted in Zambia. This month, 11 candidates were issued with the first UNESCO qualified passports in the presence of the Minister of Higher Education for Zambia. With this tool, officials say the refugees will be able to recommence their lives in the country. UNESCO says it is planning to start similar piloting programs in Iraq and Colombia. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to International Edition. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington.
This is Science in a Minute.
In 2012, NASA's Kepler spacecraft discovered 3 odd exoplanets circling a 500 million-year-old star some 2,400 light-years away. 2 years later, scientists found that the planets seemed to have a lower density than any planet in the solar system, and that they appeared to be light, fluffy, and resembled cotton candy, the favorite circus treat. A team of scientists led by researchers at the University of Colorado Boulder recently used the Hubble Space Telescope to confirm these earlier findings and find that the planets in the Kepler 51 star system represent a new class of exoplanets nicknamed superpuffs. According to NASA, although they each have a mass that's no more than several times that of Earth, because of their atmospheres of hydrogen and helium are so bloated, they are nearly the size of Jupiter. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Much attention has started to be placed on the urgent crisis of plastic in the ocean. A unique mission is underway to highlight the devastating impacts. The nonprofit organization Expedition is an all-woman group sailing around the world. It is conducting research on ocean plastic and toxic materials on human health that affect human health, animal life, and the Earth's ecosystems. My colleague Lori London spoke with Julie Anderson, Global Executive Director of Plastic Oceans International, who just got back from being part of a one leg of the 2-year all-female sailing voyage.
I really wanted to really become part of seeing it with my own eyes, and becoming part of this mission was to go into the ocean, see the plastics, be part of the citizen science of collecting data, so that not only as I go out and I talk, that people take my word becomes more credible, because I can say I've seen it. And I can honestly believe that we are contributing to a problem that's affecting the environment. And what was so unique about this organization, it's called Expedition, the XX representing the female component, because it is an all-female crew. going around the world, 30 legs over 18 months. I was fortunate enough to join the leg 4 from Antigua to Aruba and collect samples both on land, and they will be submitted to two different universities, one in University of Plymouth in the UK to analyze the plastic concentration around the world, as well as the where plastic is entering the ocean. So we actually collected samples on land, which will be submitted to the University of Georgia, where we're trying to target how the plastic's really getting into the oceans.
What do you feel like you know now that you are able to really communicate better than you would have?
It's with my own eyes, seeing that there is still a great need for awareness of plastic pollution. And then the second takeaway is really how impactful it is to educate individuals so that they go back to their communities and demonstrate their newfound knowledge and influence within their communities. And I think the reason I think it is so important to have all women, I think we forget how influential women are in society in really creating change, because women tend to be the food shoppers in their family homes, tend to influence their friend groups in their purchasing power. And with plastic pollution, those are some key ways to reduce plastic pollution.
Really good point. If you could just give a couple quick examples of what you witnessed.
From the science perspective, what I thought was interesting, which is unique to this trip, was, you know, we use the term 8 million tons of plastic ends up in the oceans. And this was based on a rough estimate from a study from 2007. And really, it was an average that they calculated. You know, we're now 12 years after the publication of that research data. And we know that we have consumed significant exponentially more. Therefore, the thought is that more is actually leaking out into the environment. But what was not taken into consideration during that research study is that the belief was that plastic's only on the surface. Unique aspect of this research study is we were taking samples from all three levels, surface 25 meters below the surface level, and also collecting sediment. And it was interesting to see plastic on all three levels, and it'll be interesting to actually have that analyzed and really incorporated into how much more negative impact the plastic is getting into our oceans.
You know, we see these pictures of mounds of plastic.
That you do not see. And then I think that is one of the harder lessons or takeaways to convince other people. Like, there's been all this attention to, there's an island of plastic. There is immediately imagine that you're going to see, you know, when you actually see it with your eyes, it is the microplastics. You're getting this breakdown of tiny, tiny particulates. Mm. And so on the surface, as you look out, it's stunning. It's shiny, shimmery waters for days as we were sailing. But then when you collect the samples and you look at it, you can see those small particulates. And that's what is so shocking. And that's what is so concerning, because it's competing in size with microorganisms that are so beneficial to the ecosystem of the oceans. And how do you really filter that out? And it's when it gets to that level, that's what's so dire, and what we believe is so dire, to stop it from the source, which is really land-based sources and other fishing, the fishing industry that is contributing to the ocean plastic pollution.
That was Julie Anderson, Global Executive Director of Plastic Oceans International, speaking with International Edition's Laurie London. Fans around the world are rushing to see Star Wars Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker. The final installment of the Skywalker saga ends a story that spawned the most successful movie franchise of all time, with more than $9 billion in global box office receipts and counting. The film's release is bittersweet for those who look back and see Star Wars woven throughout their lives. Among them is VOA's Midwest correspondent Ken Farbeau.
Born exactly 1 month after its theatrical debut in May of 1977, I grew up on a steady diet of Star Wars films, like many other American kids of that era. Through toys and merchandise, I charted the journey of Luke Skywalker from desert farm boy to galactic hero, one of many storylines that filled my imagination.
It's become this one enormous story, and you can take from it the thrill of the battle scenes. You can take from it the affection of the human characters for each other, the love indeed.
No Star Wars movies were released from the mid-1980s to the late 1990s, depriving me of new space battles or love stories in my teenage years. Undaunted, I wrote my own Star Wars screenplays, which I sent to the man I admired, creator George Lucas himself. All were politely returned, unread. Even so, my love for Star Wars never faded.
Star Wars to me has been really important in sort of looking beyond just a hero and a villain to larger questions of culture and identity.
Media and cinema studies professor Blair Davis has a simple explanation for people's fascination with Star Wars and devotion to the franchise.
It's telling us older stories about who we are and why we become the people that we seek to become.
While youthful dreams of collaborating on Star Wars projects never came true, they set me on a communications path and are a continuing part of my identity as a fan and a reporter.
For many of these people dressed up in these Star Wars costumes, it's more than just a movie, it's a way of life.
You're certainly not alone in having Star Wars as being so key to who you are, because so many of my students share the same story about what it means to them as fans and then becoming media scholars as well. It tells stories that I think are uniquely human despite all of the aliens on display. They're about family, about finding family, losing family, and about really trying to become the person that you're meant to be.
Family is central to my Star Wars story today. The love of the saga is passed on to my children. I see their imaginations fueled, as mine once was, and continues to be.
What did Han Solo have white hair?
It is sort of the end of an era of one part of the saga, but I look forward to the fact that Star Wars will live on, hopefully longer than I will, and certainly longer than George Lucas.
Although Lucas turned Star Wars over to Disney in 2012, he is still intimately connected to his creation.
It's one of the hottest tickets in town, and not even the rain will keep these fans away from the premiere.
And although he never read my screenplays many years ago, I did have an opportunity to finally speak to him at a London Star Wars film premiere in 2005.
What do you want them to take away from the whole saga?
What it is that caused you to turn to the dark side and what the consequences are.
While the Skywalker saga is ending, fans can take solace. At least three more Star Wars movies are planned for the coming decade. New characters and plot lines sure to emerge. For now, I doubt waiting in line with my children to see Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker,
will always be with you.
Or this very report. Will be the end of my continuing Star Wars journey. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Daniel Brown, engineer, John Dryden. I'm Yehiz Uhib in Washington. Thanks for listening.
Hi, my name is Larry London. Tune in on January 3rd at 1500 Universal for an interesting program on border crossings featuring the songs With Time in the title. It's the new year, 2020 is here. And we'll be playing songs from Michael Jackson, Ariana Grande, Justin Bieber, all the hits with the word time in the title. See you at 1500 Universal on January 3rd, right here on Border Crossings.
On our
voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams-Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangishaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.